I planned initially to deal with verse 29 tonight. The gifts and calling of God are irrevocable, but we're only going to cover part of that verse tonight. He's saying that the gifts and calling of the God are irrevocable, and that means that God gives the gifts and the calling to men as permanent things, gifts and calling. And in our consideration of Paul's argument regarding what he considered apparently a kind of creeping apostasy within the Gentiles and their thinking, as we've looked at that, and he calls them to account for boastfulness and high-mindedness and thinking that the wisdom that they possessed was out of themselves rather than given by revelation and by the grace of God. We've seen that Paul's intent in dealing with this problem of these attitudes is to firm up the faith in his Gentile readers in relation to the issue of the grace of God so that they do not forsake that faith. We already know, for example, from the book of Galatians that salvation faith is not believing that Jesus is the Christ. The false teachers in Galatia were teaching that Jesus was the Christ. Even the false brethren in Jerusalem who were part of the church in Jerusalem for multiple years before Paul went down there to straighten them out in terms of what the gospel was really all about, they didn't have any problem saying Jesus was the Christ. That wasn't the issue. The issue has always been the relationship of what Jesus as the Christ did in respect to our need, so that the issue of grace has always been fundamental. That's why it's called the gospel of the grace of God. And Paul's claim is that the presence of this three-in-one attitude issue that some of the Gentiles were developing indicated a crumbling confidence in grace. The first of those three-in-one attitude issues is the boasting against the Jews, and that was a negative attitude expressed outwardly toward the Jews as if the Gentile believers were somehow superior to them in a way that enabled them to boast. The second of the three was that high-mindedness, which was an inward look at themselves, with themselves thinking of how superior they were to the Jews in light of the Jewish failure to accept Jesus of Nazareth as their Christ. And then the third of the three was thinking that the wisdom that brought about the blessings of faith had its roots within the Gentiles themselves rather than in God and in his revelation to them. So that all those three are basically one, because the three dovetail into a single root that's seen from the fact that all three deny the root issue of grace. Faith in grace, according to Romans 3:27, destroys boastfulness. So if boastfulness isn't destroyed, there's a conflict in the area of faith in grace. There's a weakness or an absence of some kind. Faith in grace also destroys high-mindedness, according to 1 Corinthians 4:7. What do you have that you weren't given? And if it was given to you, why do you boast as if it wasn't? The whole idea of having something in ourselves that qualifies us, that's high-mindedness, and faith in grace destroys that. And then, thirdly, faith in grace also destroys the idea that the wisdom that has brought me to this blessedness of faith has somehow had its roots in me, in my superior intellect or something. And, of course, in our days, that's 1 Corinthians 1:21. In our days, that has shifted a bit to the concept of, well, God has given to every man free will, so it's up to individual men to choose. And, of course, as soon as you say that, the choosers can exalt themselves over the non-choosers, which breaks the whole issue of grace into pieces. And this is the creeping apostasy that Paul saw, was these attitudes were reflecting a weakness in the commitment of the Gentiles to the grace of God as the object of their faith, rather than themselves in some way being the object of their faith. So in this verse 19 and following, it goes, the paragraph runs from 25 to 32, so we're working into the tail end of Paul's reasoning, and his argument has kind of settled upon God's activities as having their roots in what he called, in our study last time, the standard of election. He said, from the standpoint of the Gospels, I admit, they're enemies for your sake, But from the viewpoint or standpoint of God's election, they're beloved. For the gifts and calling of God are irrevocable. This is a part of his argument. But he's talking about the root, and the root is in the issue of what is called the standard of election, which is the major illustration of the significance of grace, according to Ephesians chapter 1. Being chosen in him before the foundation of the world and being predestined, Paul says in Ephesians 1, 4-6, is all about to the glory of the grace of God. So that election and predestination and all that stuff is designed to highlight grace as opposed to any of the other aspects of the glory of God. That's the danger in what I mentioned to you last time when in Sunday school class the teacher says, you know, I don't even want to deal with predestination or election. As long as we're preaching the gospel, that's good enough. I don't care what you believe about that stuff. Well, the problem with that is that you're just kicking grace right out the door if you're not going to be committed to the fact that grace is God's initiative, and it started back when? From the foundation of the world. It's because the hateful Jews are within the parameters of the particular grace that God extended to the fathers, according to the statement, they're beloved for the sake of the fathers, in the form of a covenant. Because he said in verse 27, this is my covenant with them when I take away their sins. In terms of a covenant that God made to the fathers, the hatefulness of the descending generations afterwards would not be permitted to unseat this larger plan of God that he is revealing to us. This mystery that has been hidden from long ages past. And what he's actually saying is, look, God declared a plan to the fathers. They believed it. He committed himself to it in covenant form. And that settled it because they believed him. Once they believed him, his integrity was on the line. Now he's got to work it out. Well, in the working out of it, there are these problem areas of the nastiness of human beings. And as we were talking before class, the record of the kings of Israel particularly, but also many of the kings of Judah, was that they didn't... I mean, if God wanted to kick these guys out and start all over, he even threatened to do that with Moses in the wilderness. He said, get out of my way. I'm going to kill them all, and I'll start over with you. He could have done that as long as he ended up fulfilling his promise. But the problem was that he had made a promise about building a great nation for Abraham and so on. And because Abraham believed him, he had to do this. Well, what do you do with all of these reprobates like Rehoboam and Jeroboam and Ahab and all these? Now, just reprobates. And it ends up being God actually telling some of these guys that were offspring of Jacob and fit into the national scheme of things. He said, look, you're dead and all your offspring are going to be, you're not going to have anybody sit on the throne after you. They're all going to be dead because of your turning away from me. How do you put that into place? And so that's what this issue is about, is God made these promises to the Father, and the hatefulness of the current generation will not be permitted to unseat God's larger plan, because God gives gifts and calling without revoking. And in respect to that grace, those who are currently hateful are beloved, verse 28, because they form the foundations for the development of the larger plan to bring all Israel to salvation, according to verse 26. There is coming a day when the nation of Israel will be made up of all believers in that generation. All Israel will be saved, but there's not going to be an Israel to be saved if God deals with these hateful people 2,000 years prior to then, according to their just deserts. He's not going to do it. He's still operating by grace. But the whole problem was that God had shifted his attention in terms of who he's going to apply salvation benefits to in the first century. And this caused Jews heartburn big time, because they had this attitude in their own minds that there's nothing that we can do that will keep God from fulfilling his promise to us. We're his special people. We deserve this because we're, you know, we keep all the laws and And all the time operating in injustice and hatefulness, as we saw in the context of Isaiah 59 in our study of verses 26 and 27. Injustice had been exalted, and God hated it. And so he turned his attention to the nations, and he humiliated Israel by doing that. And that's why Israel hated Paul for preaching that. Now, the fact that they're beloved, even though they're extremely hateful, doesn't mean that they won't eat of the fruit of their hatefulness unless, like Saul of Tarsus, they come to faith in Christ. I mean, you can be one of this hateful generation of Jews who despise the Gentiles and also despise this way, like Saul of Tarsus did, and go about persecuting and trying to kill people for not agreeing with anything. You can be hateful like that and not eat of the fruit of your hatefulness if, in fact, you come to faith in Christ. But if you don't, then you will eat of the fruit of your hatefulness. And, of course, the Jews found that out in AD 70 when God dumped the judgment of Rome upon the nation and the town or city of Jerusalem and on the temple and just flat destroyed it as a nation and a place of worship. They found out then what the wrath of God was like. This is where we're dealing with this whole issue of how can God fulfill this plan and have patience with these hateful people in the process. And the answer is because of grace. But salvation by grace doesn't mean simply saying, I believe in Jesus. Like I said at the beginning, the false teachers said they believed in Jesus. That's not the point. It means embracing as a foundational reality the issues of why Jesus had to go to the cross in the first place. And that's the three in one. And the boasting and the high-mindedness and the wisdom that comes out of myself rather than being given by God. It means embracing grace as it really is. That I don't have anything to recommend me for the blessing that is mine. Nothing. I have nothing to recommend me to God. The only reason that I have this blessing is because God initiated, God's the one who attracted, God's the one who opened my eyes, God's the one who produced the conviction of faith. All of that was God's doing because he made a promise to somebody else, and I happened to be a part of the fulfillment of those promises. But I can't point to myself and say, well, I'm a part of it because of something in me or from me or by me or because of me. It has to be grace. This evening, I want us to consider Paul's final effort in verses 29 through 32. Like I said, we won't get there, but I want us to start looking at this final effort to turn this tide of creeping apostasy, swinging away from the demandingness of the grace of God in terms of the picture it paints of me. This is the most difficult thing that human beings face, is the reality of our depravity. At some point, you just have to get comfortable with the fact that as a sinner, as an offspring of Adam, there's something terribly broken about us. And until our redemption of the body, it isn't going to be fixed. It may be bandaged here and there may be some good that comes because the Comforter has come and the Holy Spirit has been given. But nonetheless, when we have to simply admit that we are broken, we are depraved sinners, I think that's the hardest thing in order for people to come to grips with. We always want to make sure there's something good in us that appeals to God to give us the favors. That's even partly why we bargain with him when we want something. But Paul's answer to this creeping apostasy of turning away from grace because of the bad picture it paints of us, his declaration is that God will not revoke his gifts and calling. But why did he say that? The gifts and the calling of God are irrevocable. There are some reasons for this issue to be raised right here. And the first one is Paul's own threatening words in verses 21 and 22. Because in verses 21 and 22, he implies that the gifts and calling are not revocable. If God didn't spare the natural branches, he's not going to spare you either. Watch, look at the kindness and severity. To those who fell, severity. But to you, God's kindness, if you continue in his kindness, otherwise you will be treated severely. So Paul's own words seem to support what Jesus taught in Matthew 18 in verse 35. And we looked at that where the guy has this debtors and he decides he's going to settle accounts and he calls this one steward before him and the guy owes him 10,000 talents, which is gobs and gobs of money. And he falls before his master and says, have patience with me and I'll pay you everything. Well, the master knows that isn't going to happen. And the guy that's making the foolish promise probably knows that it can't happen. But nonetheless, he doesn't want to be sold and all his family separated and sold and all that kind of stuff. So he's begging for mercy. And the king says, okay, we'll just erase your debt. And the guy gets up, and his debt's erased. And he goes out and grabs, you owe me, you know, 30 days wages or whatever. 6 months, I don't remember. But anyway, the guy says exactly the same words. Have mercy on me. Be patient. I will pay you everything. And he has him thrown in jail till everything's paid. And then the fellow servants go to the king and say, you know what that guy did? And the king revoked forgiveness that he's extended to him. Threw him in the dungeon until everything was to be paid. And Jesus says, this is the way my Father will treat you. If you treat your fellow believer or your brother like this guy did his after having been so graciously treated by his king. Those are words that are threatening. They make it sound like there is no such thing as the security of the believer. It sounds like, oh my, we're into this and we're at risk at all points. So, I think Paul raised the issue and in some ways verse 29 is a way to address that issue, but we have to understand it. There are real overtones in both verses 21 and 22 and Matthew 18 of a significant danger of a divine revoking of previously extended grace. There are real overtones of that. The danger is real. However, the issue in both of those texts and contexts is not so much what a person does as why the person is motivated to do what he or she has done. In other words, God might be irritated by what's been done, but he's more irritated by what drove it. And so the why question of why he did it, the attitude that he or she had, is ultimately answered by the what of the doer's attitude that produces the what of the doer's actions. What was this guy thinking when he went out and grabbed his debtor by the throat? What was his attitude toward him? And why was that attitude there in light of how the way he had just been treated? So both Paul's and Jesus's point is that there is a necessity for a genuinely fundamental embrace of grace as a basis for justification. Faith in grace is what brings you to justification. That's the argument of the book of Galatians. I don't care if you say you believe in Jesus. I don't have any question about your confidence that Jesus of Nazareth is your Christ. But when you tell people you got to obey the law in order to be justified, I know that your faith in Jesus is not faith in grace. That's what he said. False brethren, in danger of eternal destruction. So the issue here is an attitude about grace. And that's what he's dealing with in verses 21 and 22. They're shifting away from grace. And the shift from grace is a shift away from the faith that God is pleased by. So, that's the first reason. Paul had these words of threat built into his argument, and so in verse 29, when he says these words, they kind of come across as a little bit of dissonance, just kind of a jangling, how does this work? And the second issue is Paul's awareness of what's involved in revoking. And this is where we really want to deal with verse 29 in terms of what is involved in being irrevocable. The word in the original text, the word irrevocable, is at the very beginning of verse 29. It's the first word in the sentence. Now, in both the AB and the NASB, the word's at the end of the sentence. But the reason it's in the end of the sentence is that English and Greek are significantly different in terms of the way they communicate. In Greek, word order is not a significant issue because the way the words are spelled tells you where in the sentence the words fit in terms of how they connect. But because it's in the way the words are spelled that you can discover that, then you can take these words and you can stick them around however you want to do it, because if you put the word at the very beginning of the sentence, that means this is where you need to focus your attention, even though in English you put it at the end. The whole point here is that the word is placed in the beginning of the sentence, irrevocable, for emphasis. I use volume, change of tone, to accomplish the same thing when I'm talking. But when I'm writing, if you were to look at the notes, you would see words that were underlined and bold. That's the way of emphasis. Well, Paul didn't have a way to underline and bold and all that kind of stuff. He had to use his linguistic techniques. Let's think about this word that's so important, and he sticks it up there. Irrevocable are the gifts and the calling of the God. Irrevocable. The word is a composite of three elements. And there's a danger when you're dealing with etymology of misunderstanding, but the danger is worse if you don't understand the etymology and how the word transitioned in the way it's being used in the sentence. So we're going there. The first thing is that the word is a composite word. It's got three parts to it. The first one is what we call the alpha prefix, and it's a negator. It negates the rest of the word. It's kind of like our word atheist. What is an atheist? Well, he's the opposite of a theist, and it's that little A in front of the word that makes that the opposite of. A theist is somebody who believes in God. An atheist is somebody who doesn't. In English, it's even more clear. I don't know if you can get more clear than theist and atheist, but more clear with the prefix un. If you're successful, that's one thing. The opposite of successful is unsuccessful. So when you put this negation right on the front of the word, it means that you want the person thinking about the word, but you want to think it in terms of opposite. This is not the way it's going to be. So we're talking here about revocable. In the English, it's irrevocable. IR simply is the A negator. It's the UN and unsuccessful. It's irrevocable. But the issue is this revoking thing. And so that brings us to the second part of the word. We've said many, many times that a lot of times an author will put a prefix on the main word in order to intensify it and give some direction. Well, in this case, there is a pronoun or a preposition, that is the word meta, and it points to being, according to Robertson and his Greek grammar. Robertson's Greek grammar says if you put meta on the end or the beginning of a word, it means that you have something that's in the midst of something larger. So the idea here is that this un thing is in the midst of, or is talking about something being in the midst of something that's surrounding it. So just picture an individual who is right in the middle of a crowd. That would be your meta word. This guy is meta, this crowd. He's in the midst of it. And then you have the primary word itself, which is translated revocable. But it's used in the scriptures with the word in English, care. C-A-R-E. It means to have a care or concern for. The sense of the word cares, with the preposition fixed to it, prefixed to it, is illustrated by the parable of the soils in Mark 4, verses 15 to 20. The parable of the soils has four different kinds of soil that will determine how the response to the sowing of the word will play out. If the seed sown on this kind of soil, then this is the way it'll play out. If it's sown on this kind of soil, this is the way it'll play out. If it's sown on this kind, it'll play out this way, and so on. Well, there's four ways that the nature of the soil determines how it's going to play out. And one of those three is the seed that was sown in the midst of the thorns and the weeds. So here you have this seed, and it is sown in the midst of a whole lot of other growing competitors. The problem is the competitors are already growing, and the seed's falling in the midst of them. Which means that as the weeds are growing and the thorns are growing and all of that, they're sucking right out of the soil the moisture and the nutrients and everything that seed needs to be able to tap into in order to grow and produce a fruit or a fruitful harvest. Well, the seed germinates and it sends down a root and it starts competing for the soil, the nutrients and the moisture and all of that, and it manages to glom enough of it together to get a plant to grow up. But because there's so much competition for the nutrients and the moisture, the plant simply does not have the energy to produce any harvest. It doesn't produce any fruit. The plant grows up, but there's no seed head. There's nothing that develops. It's just, there's too much competition. And in the interpretation of that parable, we're told point blankly by Jesus that the reason that this seed didn't produce anything was because the cares of this world dragged it away from fruitfulness. In other words, the cares of this world are the thorns and the competition, the weeds and all of that. So here you get this picture of a seed that is surrounded by competitors for what it needs. And as long as it's surrounded by those competitors for what it needs, as long as those competitors are there, it will never produce a harvest. It will never produce any seed. The plant will grow up, but it will never produce anything. Well, that means then that if you're going to translate that story into a lesson to be learned, because he says the kingdom of heaven is like this, one of the things that you discover real quickly is that when a person is placed in the middle of a whole midst of multiple associations, it puts that person in a difficult position because now he has to decide what's important and what's not. He's got to go, he's got all these cares and concerns. He values this and he cares about this and he values that and he cares about that and he values this and he cares about this and he values this and he cares about this. But he discovers that all of this caring is just fragmenting him into nothing. Nothing's going to come out of this because he's spending too much effort trying to feed all of these or satisfy all of these different associations and attractions and attachments. And he just can't get focused and winnow through all that stuff. But if there's going to be any harvest, any seed on that plant, that winnowing has to be done. That's what Hebrews 12 says. We have to lay aside those things that compete for our loyalty to the truth. It's a difficult position to be in this world with many concerns, many cares, many things that are valued and held to be important. But if you get too fragmented about that, you cannot maintain the kind of loyalty to the Word of God that will enable you to be fruitful. Because all of those competitors will be vying for your loyalty rather than the Word. And that's a difficult position to be in. But, quite frankly, every one of us is in it at some point. And at that point, we have to decide whether we're going to allow the Spirit of God to winnow these concerns and cares. You know, go in there with the lawnmower and cut all those weeds and briars and stuff down. And maybe even take a shovel and dig up some of them so that the seed has an opportunity to grow and develop. The Word has to have that freedom to draw those nutrients and stuff out of that soil. And if that's not done, there will be no good. And that's what Paul was talking about when he says in verse 21 and 22, you need to be careful here. Because if you don't zero in on this grace thing and get fixed on that, then you will be subject to the severity of God. Well, in 1 Peter 5:7, Peter addresses this issue of difficulty. Because in 1 Peter 5:7 he says, cast all your cares upon him because he cares for you. The word care is our word for revoking or whatever, however you want to translate it. But the idea is, even God has multiple cares, but in his dealings with us in relation to our cares, if we're going to have those other cares winnowed out so that we can be faithful to the word, we're going to have to cast those on God. Say, here, I can't handle this, and you're going to, you know, you take this, you deal with this. I can't do this. And the only way we can do that is if we believe that he has fixed his care on us. If we don't believe that, then obviously we're not going to cast ours on him because he's not going to deal with them right. He didn't care about us. He's got his own agenda. That's Genesis 3. The serpent says, he didn't care about you. He lied. The whole issue here in 1 Peter 5:7 is a key issue of cares. How do you deal with them so you can be fruitful? Well, you have to cast those concerns on God because he cares for you. And the word that Peter used in his text, God cares for you, is actually the third part of this word. It's the part, it's the main idea. This caring in the midst of a whole lot of cares. And he says there's this negation in front of it so that you're not in this midst of all this competition. And that issue here is Paul's choice of words is an identification of just what it is that God will not sacrifice in his large group of valued objects. There are two things that he will not sacrifice. He will not revoke. He will not. And one of them is the gifts, and the other is the calling. If he gives the gift, it's done. If he utters the call, it's an irrevocable thing. It's done. So in a very real sense, I suppose we don't have any confidence in the security of the believer unless we understand that's believing in grace. So that you go to God with all your brokenness and all your need and all of that stuff, and you depend on his grace as he cares for you to take care of all these other things on your behalf. And that's exactly what the gospel is. Jesus took on all that stuff for us and all of our failure in relation to all that stuff. He took that on himself. The word is placed at the front of this sentence with a specific meaning of winnowing out what's not worth keeping a tight grip on. And Paul saying, I want you to understand that God will not revoke the gifts or the calling. And he said that to enhance the capacity to believe in it. The grace of God must be believed in order for the recipient to benefit from it. Now that brings us to this whole issue of the focus on the critical faith. Because if you remember when he told them, don't be arrogant, verse 18, and then verse 19, you will say, well, they were broken off so that I could be grafted in. And he says, quite right, they were broken off for their unbelief, but you stand by your faith. So don't be conceited, but fear. Don't be high-minded, but fear. Why? Because you're counting on your faith as the operative thing here. And technically it's not. It's what your faith is in. And that's what verse 29 is trying to get driven home. If you're believing in the grace of the God who gives the grace gifts, then you're safe. In the economy of God, faith is a critical necessity because of the consequences. In the non-relational world, the creation world, the material, the physical, laws of physics world, and they're not really laws of physics, they're laws of God, but nonetheless, in that non-relational world, it's of no real significance if you believe something or not in terms of whether it'll happen. I mean, you don't have to believe in the law of gravity, but if you violate it, you'll pay the price. You don't have to believe in it, but you are in some danger if you don't believe in it and you put yourself deliberately at risk because you're going to lose. However, Jesus said, rain falls on the just and the unjust. And it does that without any regard to what the person believes. If he believes the right thing, he's just. If he doesn't believe the right thing, he's unjust. Rain falls on them both. What's the point there? Well, the point is, that rain is for crops, for food, and all of God's food-needing creatures get this provision as a matter of grace, but it's not as a matter of faith in grace. They get it because he's gracious. Whether they believe in him or not, he feeds them day in, day out. But in the relational world, where everything is about the relationship issue, faith is the critical substructure for all of the actions that are taken. Relationships that don't begin with faith, they never exist. You can't have a relationship unless there's some trust there, some faith there. And if a relationship is started with faith, but then the faith dies, the relationship dies too. Because relationship and relating are key in their connection with faith. If you don't have faith, you're not going to be able to relate. It just doesn't work. That's why the focus is on faith, because in the relational world, that's the critical substructure. It's got to be there. Relationships can't survive. They can't even start unless there's some faith involved. And that means that anything that threatens to destroy faith is a critical concern. That's why Paul wrote this. Their faith was crumbling in the direction of confidence in the grace and the implications about their own need. It's crumbling. They're beginning to think more highly of themselves than they ought to think, because they're taking these blessings from God as some kind of indication that they're doing things right, and that is not the point of grace. So anything then that attacks this concept of confidence is a critical issue, and that's what's attacking in this paragraph, is the arrogance and the high-mindedness and the self-wisdom things. So the creeping development, boastfulness, high-mindedness, my wisdom has gotten me grace from God, these three things are forming a dire threat. That's what verse 29 was addressing, the threat. He wants to reinforce the faith. So the Bible always promises benefits to faith, and it strongly cautions against the actual failure of faith, and Paul's first word is a form of strong encouragement to continue to believe in the grace of God. But this denial of God's revoking means that once he takes this action, it's a done deal. There will be no turning back on his part. And that means there won't be any turning back on yours. This whole idea of God's giving a gift, a grace gift, or gifts, and this issue of uttering a call that gets this response that he's looking for in the calling, he's underwriting that. And if this is irrevocable, if these things are irrevocable, then there are some other commitments that are irrevocable too. Such as what Jesus said to Peter when he said, Satan has desired to sift you, but I've prayed for you that your faith fail not. Well, why didn't Peter's faith fail? He was subjected to the very nth degree of pressure from the devil. Well, his faith didn't fail because Jesus prayed for him. That's the bottom line. Well, if that's the bottom line, then that's a commitment on God's part. If he gives you a grace gift, it's yours, and you're going to benefit forever from it, because he is going to underwrite the confidence so that your faith will not fail. He's already made that commitment. Romans 8, the Holy Spirit prays for us. The Son prays for us. Hebrews, the Son is our great high priest who makes intercession for us. All of that's a part of God's commitment to make this work. The denial of the revoking means that once the action is taken by him, there are other commitments that he's also made that he is going to take action in regard to. And this truth has a very strong presence in Hebrews 6, because he says in Hebrews 6 that God made a promise and then turned around and made an oath, so that by two immutable things we might have strong confidence. That's Hebrews 6. And then in Hebrews 7:21, the issue is he made this promise and this oath. You are a priest forever after the priesthood of Melchizedek, after the order of Melchizedek. And that was a promise with an oath. Why does God need to make an oath? Well, not for his sake. If he makes a promise, it's good. But he gives the promise and then confirms it or reestablishes or reaffirms it with an oath so that we will believe him. He is doubling down on so that by two immutable things we might have strong confidence. Well, that's the whole idea here. The evaluation in this statement about the gifts and calling of God, the evaluation of how do you know whether you can trust what God has said or not, the whole thing there is whether or not you believe and you're confident, and it's backed up by what he has said in the scripture. And that evaluation doesn't come in the form of a question technically of what is believed or what is done, but in the form of existing attitudes. We can say, I believe in the grace of God. But that doesn't mean I believe in the grace of God. It just means I said it. What will really show whether I believe in the grace of God is an attitude issue in relation to these three things. Boastfulness, that's not the grace of God. High-mindedness, that's not the grace of God. Deciding that you're in this place because you have this superior wisdom that came out of yourself, that's not in the grace of God. Those three things will say, when you say, I believe in the grace of God, but these attitudes are there, these attitudes will say, no, you're lying to yourself and to anybody else that you say those words to. Attitudes are revealing. It's kind of like the guy who brought his son to Jesus' disciples who had a demon-possessed son. And Jesus was all up on the mountain with some of the others, so he went there. And the disciples said, yeah, we can cast that demon out of your son, but they couldn't. So when Jesus comes down off the mountain and he sees the hubbub that's being created there, because now there's a heated argument between the Pharisees and the scribes and the disciples and this issue of demon possession and why they couldn't cast the demon out. And Jesus says, what are you guys doing? And they said, this guy's father says, I brought my son to your disciples and asked them to cast him out, and they couldn't. If you can, please have compassion and do something. And Jesus says, if I can. And so the father, reading the disgust, says, Lord, I believe. Because Jesus said, all things are possible to him that believes. I believe. Help my unbelief. Well, what does that mean? That means I want to say I believe, but I don't really. I have a terrible need here to be affirmed that this is true, that I can depend on you to be able and compassionate enough to do this. And if that's what you're requiring of me and I don't have it, then I need your help to make that attitude there so that my son can be freed from this demon. And so Jesus cast the demon out. Well, I think that that's a classic example of the difference between saying something and actually having the attitude. The father's attitude was terror. He was afraid because the disciples had failed, that their master, their mentor, was going to fail too. But he was rebuked when he suggested that the mentor would fail. He was rebuked by the mentor, and the mentor said, if you just believe me, it'd happen. Okay, I need to be able to believe you. The whole point there is, attitudes like emotions tell us the truth. Words don't. What our tongues say don't tell us the truth. It's our attitudes and our emotions that tell us what's really going on here. So, that's the heart of Paul's paragraph here. Paul wants his readers to stop being boastful and high-minded and conceited and return to their original understanding of the grace of God, which said, if you will acknowledge your need for me, I will meet it. Well, if you're going to start denying your need in a little while, you're going to be boastful and high-minded and conceited, and there goes the faith in the grace, because the grace says, you're never going to outgrow your need for me. So it's interesting to me that even Peter, who said, cast all your diverse concerns on him, because he's not diverse, he cares for you. In that same guy's statement, 2 Peter 1:10, he says, make your calling and election sure, for if these things be in you and abound, you will never fail or fall. Well, what's he talking about? Attitudes. Just look them up. They're all attitudes. It's interesting to me that the issue of a person's security as a believer is not pressed in terms of beliefs or actions, but in terms of attitudes. Even Paul's words in 2 Corinthians 13:5, when he says, examine yourself to see if you're in the faith unless you're a reprobate. What's he dealing with? He's dealing with the attitude. The people that he was writing to, that Paul was writing to, may have been offended by his statement, you're arrogant and boastful and, you know, self-sufficient. Oh, no, we're believers in Jesus. Yeah, right. So what are these attitudes? Your disgust with the Jews and your hatred of them, their return in favor, what they've been dealing out to you. So the point is that this whole morass of attitudes, things, and how they affect us or don't is in the hands of God. The purpose of election will stand, and the gifts and the calling, once God has actually extended them, are yours forever. He'll never revoke them. But you have to be sure that they have been extended to you, and that'll show up in the attitudes you take.